Well, let's talk about you and your work and Animal Dreams, which is a lovely book and very evocative of the Southwest. I guess it's all Arizona, right? New Mexico, Arizona?
New Mexico and Arizona. Yeah, the setting of the book is a fictional place called Grace, Arizona, and then some of what happens takes place over in New Mexico on the Pueblos there. It's all the Four Corners area.
Is there a real-life equivalent to Grace?
No. It's something I invented because there was no place. I mean, I could put it roughly on a map for you, but and there are little mining towns and canyons that are colorful in Arizona, but there's nothing that had quite the magic that I wanted. I wanted a place that had, it has fruit trees and wild peacocks and a little bit of a Garcia Marquez feeling, you know, of magical realism, because I wanted to create a place where anything could happen and you would believe it.
And a long, long, dusty history to it, too.
Right, which is absolutely the way things are in those towns in the Southwest. The mining towns are usually mining camps that were established as mining camps. You know, people were brought in to work in the mines, and they have been there. And in some cases, those people have lived there since before the mines were there, and even before it was the United States. So there are places that are steeped in their own history, and places that really mean a lot to the people who live there. And that's, of course, a lot of what this book is about, is the threat of this town being poisoned to death. And the women, the old women of the town, have the most to lose. I think they're so committed to this place and feel that it's so much a part of who they are and what they are, their own identity, that they can't bear to see it lost.
How is this town going to be poisoned?
It's an old mining town, and as mines grow old and begin to be less productive, the last thing that a mining company will do is run sulfuric acid through the tailing piles. And often the sulfuric acid gets into the waterways, and that's something that, you know, really does happen in the Southwest a good bit. And in this fictional case, it's in the river is becoming acidic, and it's poisoning the fruit trees, which is the main livelihood of the town now.
It's a story of two sisters. Tell me how these two characters develop in your mind.
I always start writing a book with a question in mind, and it has to be a really big, important question, one that I'm willing to be married to for a year or two, however long it takes to write the book, and a question to which I don't know the answer, because what's the point of writing the book if you already know the answer? The question I started with here was something like this. Why is it that people make the choices they do, particularly the political choices they do? How is it that some people become engaged with the world and its problems and are capable of dreaming of a better world and pursuing that dream, and other people have no dreams at all? They turn their backs on the world and feel, you could say, disenfranchised. They feel incapable of action, that nothing they can do could make any difference. And those two sorts of people can occur in the same family. And you know, I mean, I think we all know families where there's maybe one sister is a peace activist and a brother builds bombs or something like that. So I became really curious about how this happens, and I don't know that in every case it happens the same way, but in this case, I created this fictional family where one sister, at the opening of the book, is headed south to work in the as an agronomist in the fields of Nicaragua, where farmers are being ambushed by the Contras. She's following her dream there, and her sister Cody is a cynical sort of person who believes in nothing, and she's fallen into despair. She's kind of at the end of her rope, and she is about to go back to her hometown of Grace, where her father is beginning to show the early stages of Alzheimer's. So it's about these two sisters, and particularly about Cody, as I worked on uncovering the roots of her despair, the sort of the root causes of how she had come to feel so dreamless, you know, so despairing.
Yeah, Cody almost has dropped out.
I mean, she was just a few months shy
of medical school.
Yeah, she's a dropout. Yeah, she's never quite finished anything. She just came back and working in a
7-Eleven?
Yeah, right. She doesn't really believe she's capable of anything. I think at one point in the book she says something like, I marked myself early on as a bad risk, incapable, undeserving of love and incapable of generosity. So that's the sort of person she is. And the story is largely about working backwards in time, finding out how she got this way, and as I discovered how she got that way, I was also able to get her out of it, to find a course of action that would give her hope.
I would assume that one of the chief reasons that she came that way was her unexpected pregnancy and the death of, I guess, a stillborn baby.
Uh-huh, and the death of her mother. She's had a hard fall from paradise. I think all of us fall at one time or another from that original state of grace when we discover that our parents can't protect us from the terrible things in the world. But for Cody, that's been a particularly hard fall, and she suffered in ways that her sister Hallie didn't, even though they were in the same family.
That is kind of scary in a way, to see the vulnerability of your parents and to find that you have to make it on your own, isn't it?
That's right. And I think that the process of moving from that terrible state of feeling that you're an orphan into some other state where you're capable of something more, capable of action, involves largely figuring out how to be your own parent and figuring out how to take care of yourself. And that's what Cody is doing. Another reason that she's really such an empty person is that she literally doesn't know who she is. The book is a little bit like a mystery in its construction, because Cody has been told a story. There's this family myth that their father told his two girls, which she comes to discover is a lie. She's never known who she really is and where she really comes from. And in the course of the novel, she keeps turning up clues.
And, of course, the biggest mystery is, who was her mother?
Right. Who was her mother? Who was her father? Where did they come from? Who is she, Cody? And how is it that she grew up in this town where she feels she was never loved and never quite belonged? Why does she feel that no place she's ever lived will take her in as a place she could call home? Those are the answers that she finds during the course of the novel. And of course, part of it has to do with this environmental crisis that she becomes involved in. And part of it has to do with another character we haven't talked about yet, and that's Lloyd Peregrina.
Partly Apache. I guess he got some Pueblo in him.
Right, his
Spanish.
Mother's Pueblo, and his father's Apache. And he comes from a different worldview of
cockfighters.
Right, yeah, he's a cockfighter and a locomotive engineer, and his name is spelled wrong. And he doesn't look much like a philosopher to Cody, you know, or much of a prophet, but as she gets to know him, she begins to realize he has a lot of wisdom that is completely new to her and really sort of startles her out of some of her complacency and is really good for her.
Now, Animal Dreams, tell me the significance of the title.
Cody and Lloyd talk about a lot of things she's never even thought about before, and at one point they're having a conversation about what animals might dream about. And Lloyd says he believes that animals dream about whatever they do in the daytime. If a dog chases rabbits in its life, then that's likely what it will dream about. And he says that people do the same, that our dreams really aren't separate from us, that they come up out of what we ordinarily do, not just our night dreams, but our dreams and what we hope for. He says that if you want sweet dreams, you have to live a sweet life.
Well, that's nice.
Well, thank you.
Animal Dreams is not your first book. Tell me about some of your earlier work.
My first book was a novel called The Bean Trees. This is my second novel. And in between, I've written two other books. My second book was a collection of short stories called Homeland and Other Stories, also published by HarperCollins. Back then it was Harper and Row. And my third book is a nonfiction book called Holding the Line, Women in the Great Arizona Mine Strike of 1983.
Bean Trees, is that also set in Arizona?
Yeah, mostly. It begins in Kentucky and travels west, which is something I have also done in my life, although I don't write about myself, really. That would be not nearly interesting enough. I would much rather make things up. But that my writing surely has followed the course of my own life geographically.
Sure, there's some parallels. I would assume that would make it vastly easier to write than to have the action move from, say, Maine, where you might never have been.
Right. That would be impossible for me to write about Alaska or someplace I've never been. You have to write about what you know, particularly in terms of place and in terms of, for example, occupation, what people do. You have to know a whole lot about those things, because what makes a novel believable is the details. You know, the details of place, the small details of what people do and what they say and how they talk. And you have to believe it, or you won't. I mean, why would you keep reading about people who you absolutely know are invented? Let's face it, it's all a lie. You know, I made this up. Why should you keep turning pages unless some part of you really believes that these are real people that you love and you have come to care about, and you need to know how it all turns out for them?
Well, it's said that true fiction, as opposed to, say, genre fiction, science fiction and romance novels, mm-hmm. and this sort of thing, mm-hmm. But the kind of literary fiction seeks to find the greater truth.
That's right.
But it has to also be credible. I mean, you have to find a place and people who are meaningful.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes the best way to tell the truth is to make up a story. Actually, Ursula Le Guin has a wonderful essay about that I like very much, in which she talks about telling the truth in fiction. And she says the artist must say what cannot be said in words. The writer, the fiction writer, must say in words what cannot be said in words. And I think what that means is, well, the things that cannot be said in words are the things that are just too enormous to have any meaning anymore, like love your neighbor. You know, so what? You know, we've heard that before. It doesn't mean anything. It falls flat. I might as well say wear clean socks. You know, it's nothing new. But if I can invent a story with characters and incident that show you why, if you don't love your neighbor, you encounter disaster, then somehow I can create for you a truth that you weren't willing to listen to in simple words, but can somehow through the back door get into your heart and make you believe.
By the same token, I think the writer's immediate goal is, however, to tell a story. An engrossing story that people are going to want to follow.
Sure, you have to entertain. I mean, I want to say something important in what I write. I think there are already plenty of books in the world.
People say too many.
Well, think about the Library of Congress. I mean, it's depressing. I'll never get around to all of those. Why should I even get up in the morning? How can I be so audacious as to presume I have something new to add to all that? I can only do it if I'm motivated by some sort of intense urgency in me to say something to you that I really need for you to know. And that's really my point of origin in writing fiction. I begin with theme, with what it is I want you to know about the world, what I would like you to think about. But of course, I can't tell you what to believe. That would be a pamphlet, it wouldn't be a novel, and it wouldn't be any fun, and it would not be art. So what I also must do is entertain you, and we have a contract, is the way I look at it. if I just sat down next to you on the subway and said, you sit there and listen to me for 10 hours, you would, I suppose, call the police. I mean, you'd think I was nuts.
Or if
you
even just spoke to me for 10 seconds.
Right. But really, in a book, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, sit down and listen to me for 10 or 12 hours of your life. So I can't expect you to do that unless I give you a reason to turn every single page and keep going. So I have to compel you, and the best way to do that is to make you laugh, to make you believe that these people are real, and to make you like them, even love them, and maybe to make you cry, but overall to make sure that you keep going.
It's kind of interesting to touch on what we just spoke about. I've talked to some people who say, yes, there are too many books in the world. Why don't we just call a halt right now and get caught up with what we have.
Our reading.
That's right. We get caught up with what we've written at least over the last 50 years. Because I believe there must be thousands and thousands of worthwhile books that have just been eviscerated. We don't know where they are. They're gone.
They're out of print.
They're out of print. Mm-hmm. Or were perhaps never even read to any degree when they first came into print. And they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
There must be a wonderful group of writers that are no longer in our conscience.
It's probably true, although they probably can be found in the deepest stacks of a library somewhere.
No. What happens? No, libraries are... Libraries are very, very selective, and they weed through their shelves all the time.
That's true.
That's terrible.
Yeah,
I was trying to write something about Ambrose Bierce a while back, and I kept going to the Midtown Manhattan branch to look at Bierce's collected works,
mm-hmm.
and they were only in two New York City libraries, mm-hmm. the main library and this branch. And this was a 12-volume collection of almost everything Bierce had written. I went back one afternoon and I saw that the books were taken off the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
I panicked. I found the librarian. I said, where is the collected works? And the librarian said, I knew the first day we took those off the shelves, somebody would ask for them.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but nobody's reading them, so we're going to give them away. We're going to put them up in a library sale. He said, if you want to buy them, I'm sure we can sell them to you. And I bought them.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think that there would be some market for Ambrose Bierce, but they're taking him off the shelf.
To make way for what's new.
For new books, for different books.
I suppose that's only heartbreaking because of our expectations. A lot of media are ephemeral. I mean, if there's a play you want to see, you go see it now. You don't expect to wait around 10 or 12 years and go see it because you know it will be gone. But it's true that literature, or the books we expect to be enduring, we expect that they'll always be there, which is, I suppose, also an audacious expectation, but it's true. I guess we do all, I mean, authors too, operate under that assumption that what we say will be around after we're not, which is a little daunting too. I think about that, frankly, just about every day. It scares me a little, and I want to make sure that this message I'm putting in the bottle for the future is exactly the right one.
You can only hope, and there's no way to know. Just no way. Why books? Some books hang on, and some of them have a rebirth. Some academic will discover a book and write a paper or
mm-hmm.
write a new biography of a, mm-hmm. of a practically unknown author, and there's a renewed interest.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? We just don't know why it happens. I understand that in Dickens' day, I don't know all their names, but I understand that there were writers who were vastly more popular than Dickens, but Dickens held on. And now, Dickens, you can go to the library and find him. I can guarantee it.
Of course. Yeah, and at the time he was writing for magazines.
Right.
He was writing
serials,
sort of soap opera serials. But, of course, people were waiting for the boat to deliver.
But he had wonderful characters and situations that just have... They still ring in our imagination. They just don't.
Oh, absolutely! Right. Dickens is one of my models. There are certain writers I read. Well, I learned to write from reading books. I didn't. I studied other things in school. I didn't study writing in school, but I studied writing by reading. And I read Virginia Woolf a lot, and I read Dickens a lot because of the wondrous complexities of his characters and his plots. And also I like the fact that he writes about real people surviving on what they make, which is barely enough. You know, he writes about what in his day was considered maybe marginal material for art.
Where did you grow up in Kentucky?
The eastern part of Kentucky, sort of wedged in between the bluegrass and the mountains. It was tobacco farming.
Eastern part, not near Ashland.
Yeah, kind of up towards Ashland.
What was the name of the town?
Well, it was called Carlisle.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever heard of it.
No. What kind of family? A literary household?
Not terribly. We certainly had books. I credit my parents for not having a TV. I'm sure that's why I write. I'm a writer, because books were my sole form of entertainment as a child. I read enormously, and I had a whole imaginary life in my mind. You know, Joe March was my best friend, you know, and the March girls from Little Women were my companions, and Treasure Island, you know, all of those things incited my imagination. And I think that people who read learn to, it's an active process. You read and you have to create pictures in your mind. And I think that, you know, when you listen to the radio, you do that too. But if you don't do either of those things, you either never develop that capacity or you lose it.
Yes, reading a book is almost like, to me, like watching a movie
mm-hmm.
unfold.
Exactly. Exactly. It's even better than watching a movie, because the people look exactly the way you want them to, and a strong female character may look a little bit like your mother, or a little bit like your sister, or a little bit like this teacher you had in high school. It has all these elements from your own life that you've created, so it means a lot to you. After you go see the movie, then that character looks like Meg Ryan, or whoever plays her, and everyone who sees that movie will come away having one single image of that character, whereas a million people who read a book will have a million different images of each character.
Well, where did you go to school?
I went to college at DePaul University in Indiana and mm-hmm. studied biology and a lot of other things there. I was sort of a professional major changer. I guess I always thought I was a little flaky, because I wanted to know everything. I wanted to know about archaeology and history and languages and art history and chemistry. And then I also went to graduate school in ecology and evolutionary biology. And when I became a fictionist...
Excuse me, did you go to graduate school at DePaul as well?
No, that was in Arizona. In
University of Arizona?
Yeah, in Tucson, where I live now. Mm-hmm. But I was so happy to become a fiction writer, because that's a field where you have to know a little bit about everything, or actually a lot about everything. If you think about it, all of your characters have to have jobs, or they have to be unemployed, but that's sort of a profession too. And you have to know the details of all of those professions. And we talked a little earlier about the details of what people do being the stuff of fiction. It's not the generalities. So you have to be as smart as all your characters, and you have to be as witty as all your characters. You can't just say, "Then he said something very witty and everybody laughed." You have to think of what it is. So having had a lot of different jobs myself, and having lived a lot of different jobs and living in a lot of places.
Didn't work
in
the 7-Eleven, did you?
Oh, I have. I've done worse, I have to admit. Having done all those things is enormously useful to me now. And of course, you know, I rely on my friends too. I have a good friend. My best friend, in fact, is a locomotive engineer, and I relied heavily on her for all of the locomotive details in this novel. The railroad people have their own language.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you never left Arizona once you graduated from graduate school, didn't you?
No, but I lived a lot of other places in between before I got to Arizona. I was a rolling stone. I moved to Tucson on a whim. I had no good reason, no good, you know, adult reason for going there. But I had this idea of what the Southwest would be like, and I was pretty much right. I like it a lot.
It sounds very romantic, if I read Animal Dreams correctly.
It is. It's a little bit wild, and it's it's a little bit romantic, and it's very rich culturally. There's a wonderful cultural plurality in the Southwest that's a little different from the cultural plurality you have here, which is a plurality of immigrants, but it's also a melting pot where people have come and tried to be similar in many ways in their lives. But in the Southwest, well, there are the immigrants who've arrived there in the last 100 years, and there are people who've come there from all parts of Latin America who bring their cultural contributions, and then there are the Native Americans who've been there always, well, for thousands of years, who have profoundly different worldviews, so that you can drive through Arizona and you can pass through maybe 5 or 6 or 7 different nations where you don't just have different ethnic foods, but also different languages and different creation myths. So that's a really rich soil for a writer.
Mm-hmm. So after this peripatetic background of biology and 7-Elevens and even worse, did you suddenly decide, hey, I'm going to write a novel? One day I'm going to write a novel, and you sat down and did it? I mean, it certainly had to be an evolutionary process.
Well, I've always written. I just never imagined that I could get paid for it. I always wrote stories, and I've always kept journals from since I was a child. It's something that I did more or less on the sly because it didn't seem quite grown up to me to admit that I made up stories. You know, now it's quite wonderful to admit to the world that I do this and someone pays me for it. I did though work as a writer in a slightly more in what seemed to me at the time a more grown-up job. I had, after I finished graduate school, I worked as a scientific writer at the University of Arizona. And it was a great revelation to me that I could sit at a desk and write all day and draw a salary for that. So I was very excited about that and kind of took it to the streets. I worked as a freelance writer after that, a freelance journalist.
It's probably good in terms of discipline, in the way that a journalist might find writing and good in terms of discipline.
You know, people talk about discipline, but for me, I mean, the day I became a professional fiction writer and was able to do that every day of my life from 8 to 5:30, which is when my daughter is in daycare, I felt that I had won the lottery. For me, the discipline comes when I have to stop writing and go in the house and start dinner or something. It requires no discipline to do what you love.
Well, that's a different story. What I meant in terms of discipline was in terms of marshaling words, putting them down
well,
on
I
paper
suppose,
in
yeah,
a coherent way.
Yeah, I see what you mean. There's this romantic image of, well, all the arts, including writing, that suggests that really writing is about sitting with a pained expression on your face and holding your hand out, waiting for the golden apple to fall in your hand, you know, for the muse to speak to you. And of course, that's not what it's about at all. Writing is not about waiting around for something else to do the work for you. It's about doing the work yourself. It's about sitting at a typewriter or a word processor and using your finger muscles and your head muscles and turning out words and then revising them endlessly.
Well, it's not the easiest task either, and you're doing it all by yourself.
Oh, I don't know. There are people who talk about what a curse it is to be a writer, but I think it'd be a curse to be one of those people I saw painting the Queensboro Bridge today or putting tar on the streets.
How do you know they're not writers?
Well, they might be, but it's not what they're doing for a living, and maybe they love their work too. I hope so, but I think it's no curse to be a writer. I think it's great fun.
It's fun reading Animal Dreams, very moving book, and as I said at the opening, very evocative of the Southwest. It sounds beautiful, romantic, a place I have yet to be, but would like to go. Barbara Kinsolve, a beautiful book. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.